Well, good morning, everyone.
This is our regular Labor Day weekend Get in Gear talk. And if you're a runner, you're familiar in the spring, they have a Get in Gear run along River Road. Well, this is the Get in Gear talk. And we call it Get in Gear for a number of reasons. One is that it's starting after Labor Day, the Zen Center starts a series of classes. So things kind of pick up. Summer's a little quiet. This is maybe the fifth or sixth or seventh time I've given this talk. And I see the same old faces who probably need a Get in Gear talk. So we'll see how we go. If you look at the brochure, you'll see that what I want to talk about is seven kind of practices that we can use kind of as a focus to Get in Gear. And I might say we're starting a new morning schedule for introduction to Zazen. It starts at the very same time the Dharma talk starts. So we're going to see people wandering back and forth. It has to be worked out a little bit. So if you see somebody who looks a little lost, just a point upstairs, if you will. So I want to talk about seven practices that, or eight practices that we can incorporate into our Zen practice. And usually Zen is kind of interesting. It's one of those practices, etc., where people don't talk about practice. And in fact, a talk about practice is thought to be not kind of a cool way to proceed, if you will. And there's kind of a history to it a little bit. I thought I'd just mention that in China, after about the 3rd century AD, there was a lot of argument about within Zen about the best way to practice. And in the early 8th century, there was a monk called Sen Hui, who was an evangelical type. He used to rail against everybody who did not have his particular kind of practice. And in those days, oftentimes we get the picture that Zen monks practiced in caves, they lived in forests, things like this. They were pretty isolated. In reality, of course, they lived in huge state-run monasteries that were funded by the emperor. There was always a fear that you could fall out of favor, if you will, and not be funded, etc. So after Sun He, it became the practice for people not to talk very openly about what their practice was. You know what I mean? And so it's kind of carried on into Zen today. But what I want to do basically is kind of actually talk about some real practices. Because I found in my own practice, when I first came here in 1976, and so I've been around for a long time, and I found in my own practice that a mature Zen practice basically is a result of years of study and hard work. It's just not a matter of just sitting. And you hear that expression in Zen a lot, just sitting. And you go to introductory course and they say, watch your breath. And you get the impression, well, that's it. But in actuality, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of knowledge. In the Buddha's original, eight-step path, if you will, he really balances meditation or interior concentration with right view or knowing, if you will. You can read all the books, you can understand, but without meditation and practice, etc., it doesn't deepen. You can sit, just sit, but if you don't have right view, that is a deep understanding of the Buddha's teaching, etc., you're just sitting in some kind of sense, if you will. So Zen is kind of a paradoxical kind of practice in the sense that you're told to just sit, but to really know how to just sit, you need a huge amount of background effort and knowledge, if you will. I'm going to concentrate on seven practices. The first is the practice of meditation, which is really a core practice in Zen Buddhism. We're familiar with the word meditation. It can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. It can mean, for example, learning to relax or trying to empty your mind. But in Buddhism in general, meditation refers to training the mind. And we have to keep that in mind, training the mind. And in this practice period, which starts near the end of the month, we're going to use a book called the Dharmapada, which is the Buddha's kind of original teaching. And the very first verse in the Dharmapada says, "All that we are is a result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfish thoughts cause misery when they speak or act. Sorrows roll over them as the wheels of a cart roll over the tracks of the bullock that draws it. All that we are is a result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfless thoughts give joy whenever they speak or act. Joy follows them like a shadow that never leaves them." And so part of our training is to learn, of course, what's a selfless thought or what's a selfish thought. And so this is part of our basic training, if you will. There are many ways to organize or think about meditation. In Buddhism, basically, we usually put meditation into two kind of parts or categories or practices, if you will. And one is what we call, and I'm not going to use formal terms, but one is what we call attention or cultivating attention. And this is being able to focus on something like your breath or a mantra, etc., in an uninterrupted way for some time. I think most of you here have probably meditated a bit, and we're all familiar with something we call monkey mind in Buddhism. And that is that you sit, you think it's pretty easy, right? And you sit and you start counting your breath. You think you're going to go up to 21 or something like that, and you get up to 3, and pretty soon you realize you've locked the kid in the car. You know what I mean? Whatever. And so your mind goes here or there. You forget basically where you are. So one aspect of attention of a meditation is really to change your mind, to train your mind to be one-pointed, to cultivate attention. And I might say that there's an attention revolution going on in medical circles in North America. There are things like what's called the inner kids group, teaching kids to actually sit and watch their mind, which is something, when I was a kid, something would never have occurred to me, to sit and be observant. You know, what's going on up there, if you will. So that's part of it. The second kind of practice of meditation is what I'll call awareness. And that is not just paying attention, but being aware about what's happening. And I'll say more about that. What kind of thoughts are coming up, if you will? Are they sad thoughts or happy thoughts or whatever they might be? A lot of us live our lives with what we call a reactive emotions, if you will. Somebody says something we dislike, and we have a certain pattern way of responding that really, in a way, helps define our personality with these reactive emotions, etc. And so part of awareness meditation is sitting and really becoming aware, of your kind of reaction, what really goes on, in your mind. It's often said in Buddhism that there are three stages of meditation. And, of course, in Soto Zen, we don't usually talk about stages and ladders. But remember, this is a Labor Day getting gear talk, so we can talk about those kinds of things, etc. And the first stage, is the realization through a lot of practice that you're not your body. If you can observe your body, you're not your body, etc. You can observe it. And through that realization, that realization has a lot of consequences. One is that you realize the body basically is the ultimate costume. And whether you're male or female or old or young or handsome or less handsome or whatever, etc., that's a costume. That's a basic part of our understanding. A second stage is to realize that we're not our mind. That we can sit there in our awareness meditation and watch these thoughts come up. And our brain basically is a thought generator. Just like sparks come up, thought, etc. They can be disconnected. They can be all kinds of things. And if we think of those thoughts as our mind, etc., and we can observe them, we're not our mind. Dogen's teacher, Rulane, Dogen was the kind of the Japanese founder of our particular lineage of Soto Zen, etc., said, if I can find it, he said, where is Rulane? He said, Zen practice is the falling away of body and mind. And Dogen himself, his enlightened experience, he always said, was the falling away of body and mind. And it's the realization, basically, that you're not your body, you're not your mind. And to me, one of the greatest realizations in my own meditation practice was that realization, because it gave me space. It gave me space between how I felt bodily, my sensations, etc., and my thought. I realized I'm not my thought, and so I didn't become entangled with them. That's a very important realization. The third stage, basically, is realizing that you are not the observer. Because in this whole process, somebody is observing, right? You're observing your body. You're observing your mind, etc. In Buddhism, we say that every being has three basic characteristics. And one is a non-permanence. Non-permanence, nothing's permanent, if you will. The second is some kind of dis-ease or suffering, a universal, etc. The third is non-self, the fact that we're non-self. And one of the hardest concepts, basically, to grasp in Buddhism is the idea that you're not an I or a me or a person, what that might mean, etc. And so this third stage of realization is that realization, to give up the thought of me or I and let it go. Katagiri Roshi, who was the founding Japanese monk of this center, used to say that letting go, the letting go of I, was the most difficult thing in Buddhist practice. It's something you held on to and held on to and held on to, etc. So that's a little background about meditation to develop a practice. It also helps to realize that the mind itself is a trickster. And I don't know if you're familiar with the word trickster, but in American Indian religions, etc., a trickster basically is somebody who might take on a different shape, mislead you down the wrong path, you know, all kinds of things like this. And in Buddhism, we have a figure called Mara, who's something like a trickster, you know, trying to move you away from the path. And we have to realize that the mind does not want to be tamed, if you will. And therefore, the trickster part of us is always thinking of ways, basically, to get us off the path, if you will. So we often say in Buddhism that one of the easiest things to do is to sit there in meditation. And one of the hardest things to do is to do it well. And so we all want to be a Shambhala warrior, if you will. And I think we've all heard that expression that the hardest battle one fights is the battle within. And that is against the trickster, if you will. Well, a second kind of practice, and one we don't do a lot in our particular form of Buddhism, but a really useful one, is to work with a mantra. And a mantra is some kind of expression that we repeat, repeat, etc. And I've used this example before, but I like it, so I keep using it. And that is, a mantra is like an elephant's trunk. And I didn't grow up around elephants, but an elephant's trunk is a curious thing, and it goes here and there and all over. And so in India, when they have processions through the villages, etc., and they go through the market, that elephant's trunk is reaching out, grabbing bananas or coconuts or whatever the heck. You know, of course, the people in the market get all upset. So what they do in India is they take a bamboo pole, and they have the elephant hold that bamboo pole. And, of course, wanting to be a good elephant, it holds it up with pride, etc. And thus it controls its trunk. And a mantra, in a sense, is the same thing. It's our bamboo pole. We talked about monkey mind that's going to flit all over the place, etc. A mantra helps us center and basically stabilize our thoughts. Mahatma Gandhi wrote, "The mantra becomes one staff of life and carries one through every ordeal. It's not repeated for the sake of repetition, but for the sake of purification. It's an aid to effort. It is no empty repetition, for each repetition has a new meaning, carrying you nearer and nearer to whatever your supreme reality is." And his mantra was Rama, meaning to rejoice. So basically a mantra should have some kind of meaning, if you will. And Christianity uses mantras, though they might not call it that. It's usually called the holy name. And so when you meditate, and of course there's a great meditation tradition in Christianity, etc., you might just say, "Jesus, Jesus." Or you might say the Hail Mary. I have a Catholic background, and I, those things always come up in mind. In Buddhism, there are many mantras. One is Om Mani Padme Hum, which really means the lotus in muddy water. And that's a wonderful image if you're familiar with Buddhist readings. Because the lotus starts in mud, basically muddy water, and then it emerges when it's white and pure, etc. And so I always think of when I use that mantra myself, basically, as kind of an emerging locus out of muddy water. Of course, the muddy water being the defilements, if you will, the kind of things that the unwanted things, basically, in our life. Another mantra that you hear frequently, and this is one that our head abbot, Tim Burkett, used when he was at the San Francisco Zen Center, that his teacher, Suzuki Roshi, actually had him use. It's really the last line of the Heart Sutra, and it goes, "Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisattva." And it means gone, gone, altogether gone. Altogether gone to the other side. Enlightenment. So cool. I like that. That's the last part. So cool, if you will. A teacher will give you a mantra, though you can pick your one out. Usually a mantra should be traditional, etc. It's something that you can use throughout the day. You repeat it yourself throughout the day. It has healing power, etc. A third kind of practice that we can all use is what we call slowing down. Slowing down. And it's a good Zen practice. We all get into multitasking. I was thinking to myself a week ago, etc., watching TV, petting the cat, etc., thumping my foot and reading the magazine at the same time. I think we all have that kind of experience, if you will. What we really want to do is to learn to actually slow down, listen, if you will. Mindful listening is a powerful practice. The last talk I gave was on the Zen of listening, if you will, because we get into the habit of sitting there waiting for someone to stop so we can talk. We're all familiar with that. We're not really listening to what they're saying, etc. And one of the greatest gifts we can give, whether you're Buddhist or not, basically, is mindful listening. To really listen to what a person has to say, and we don't do that enough. To do that, basically, you have to slow down and really listen. Henry David Thoreau, who most of you are familiar with, an early American poet, says, "I have no time to be in a hurry. I have no time to be in a hurry." And I like that. And these are kind of expressions, etc., that we should learn and write down. I have no time to be in a hurry. And we have our practice, etc. So slow down at work. Practice patience at every opportunity, if you can. It's a hard practice because we have deep ruts, if you will, the way we actually react, etc., oftentimes not thinking, etc. Our life basically is built upon reactive patterns. To actually recognize, identify, and see them arise, etc., we have to be patient, we have to slow down, we have to listen, etc. So it sounds like a simple thing, slow down, but it's an absolutely fundamental part of our practice. A fourth practice is what we call one-pointed attention. And it sounds a little bit like cultivating attention in meditation, but it's not done within a meditation setting. It's done within a daily setting. And so if you're washing dishes, driving a car, talking to the kids or your significant other, etc., basically what you're trying to learn to do is to concentrate upon a subject, if you will. And again, many of us are so used to multitasking, etc., that you think, well, of course I pay attention. And then when you really say, well, I'm going to pay attention, you know, for the next 10 minutes, you find out it's not as easy as you think. In fact, learning to pay attention is a precious gift that we all should have, etc., not only for ourselves, but for other people, etc. And you can learn to train your attention by using a mantra, by using meditation, things like this, etc. So, again, going back to listening, you know, a good place to work on attention is listening. Because we all talk with people every day, and it's just a wonderful opportunity, you know, listen to what basically they have to say, etc. A fifth practice again is learning to train our senses. Just as we have to train our mind, or we train our mind, we train our senses, etc. And one way to think about the senses, and the way I like to think about them, is our senses are like puppies, if you will. They're all over the place. They have short attention spans. They take a nap. You know, they do all kinds of things like that, etc. So senses, senses are like puppies, if you will. And what I'm talking about here is watching what we eat, for example. You know, what goes into our mouth, etc. What goes into our eyes and ears when we watch television? Is it some violent program, etc., etc.? Are we overindulging in sweets or drugs, if you will? Something like that. We come back when I said that we're not our body, when I said the body is the ultimate costume, etc. And another way to think about it is because we're not our body, we have a special obligation to it. Just like a pet. And many of us probably take better care of our pets than we take care of our body. Because we don't think of our body as a pet, if you will, or as a costume, etc. But the minute you start thinking about it that way, etc., is an extension, etc., then it becomes something else, etc. There's an old Sufi saying about watching what you say, etc., that is guarding what comes through the gate of your mouth. And it always says, everything that comes through your mouth should pass you through gates, three gates. The first is it true? And the second is it necessary? And the third is it kind? Is it kind? Etc. And again, by slowing down, by holding your attention, etc., by thinking about training your senses, etc., this is another way. Just watch what you say, watch what you say, watch what you say, if you will. A sixth training, again, is putting others first. Putting others first. And again, you might think, oh, sure, I do that. But lots of us have elephantitis of the ego, if you will. Or at least, at the very least, if we're not grossly egotistical, we're at least self-absorbed. Which is a kind of something else. The Buddha said, for those whom ego overcomes, suffering spreads like weeds. Suffering spreads like weeds. Remember, we talked about meditation as training of the mind, etc. And we read that part of the Dharmapada, etc. You know, that the way you see the world is a projection of your mind, etc., if you will. Jesus said, if you want to find your life, you have to lose it. And there's a very famous quote we hear all the time from Dogen, again, the founder of our Soto lineage. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. Gandhi was known as a very quiet, almost meek individual. So when somebody asked him, have you no ambition? Gandhi said, oh no, I have the greatest ambition imaginable. I want to make myself zero. I want to make myself zero. The problem a little bit in our society where people are self-absorbed, there seems to be a premium on ego and projection, etc., to actually be zero. You can be perceived as meek, etc. But that's part of our practice, Put other people first. Also, there's a deeper part of it, and this goes back to the idea of non-self in Buddhism, etc., that when we look at those, there's something called three poisons, etc., and there's greed, for example, is one, there's dislike is another, the third is ignorance, etc. And ignorance really is ignorance about what's essential in the Buddhist teaching, etc. And at the very core of that is this idea of self, that there's who has greed, etc. The self. And so that's very important if you want. So we can say one of the great meditation practices that one can use are what's called the four immeasurables. When I've talked about meditation, I've talked about watching your breath, that is cultivating attention. I've talked about being aware of what arises, your reactive emotions. All of these are about yourself, right? And they have to do with training yourself. But, of course, as a certain kind of Buddhist, etc., our attention, remember, is about others. And so how do we switch our attention to others? And the four immeasurables are a bridge that does that. The four, basically, the first is loving kindness. And so you learn to do meditations in which you say, and you can start with a person that you really like, because it produces these emotions. You can say, may whoever, have experienced love in the roots of love. And then you have yourself, and you go down to maybe somebody that you don't know well, the person who serves your coffee. And then if you're up to it, you go down to somebody you actually don't like for whatever reason, etc. And then if you can really stand it, you go down to somebody you really hate, the second of the four immeasurables is compassion. And the difference between loving kindness and compassion is, in compassion, basically, there's something wrong with something, that there's somebody sick or ill or something. Loving kindness is just flowing out of love, etc. The third is empathetic joy, and that is the joy that you experience for somebody else is good fortune. Let's put it that way. And so somebody comes up and says, I just won the lottery. And you say, how many million? Or whatever. It's just, and again, this goes to ego, etc. And then the fourth of the four immeasurables is equanimity. And equanimity is not riding high, not riding low, etc. It's a wonderful practice, and there are wonderful books and teachings on it if you're interested. And in this regard, remember, everyone knows John Donne's lines, no person is an island entirely of itself, every person is a piece of the continent. And in Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh always talks about inter-are. He uses that expression, we all inter-are. But one of the really most basic teachings of the Buddha, but one we don't hear much about in Western Buddhism, etc., is dependent origination. And I won't go into details, but it's just the idea that every effect is a result of causes and conditions. Nothing exists independently by itself. And this is basically the reason why there is no self. That we're, you know, what we think is a self is a result of conditions and causes, things like this, if you will. So the root of all this, putting others first, as we say, be on fire with love for all. And I like that. I have a little note on the wall. Be on fire with love for all. And then the seventh practice is spiritual companionship. And an important part of, as I mentioned, that one of the most difficult practices, etc., is to actually maintain a meditation practice. Remember, your mind is a trickster, etc. It doesn't want to be tamed, etc. Things like this. And so one of the best practices is to work with like-minded people or be around like-minded people. That doesn't mean you come to the Zen Center necessarily, but you may invite people to your home. And you might have a little table where you put a flower and a little Buddha and things like this, and then just invite people to come and sit with you. And a lot of people find that it's easier, basically, to sit with other people than just by themselves. When you practice Buddhism, we talk about taking refuge. And so we have these chants, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma, which is the Buddha's teaching, and also the way of the world. And then I take refuge in the Sangha, and the word Sangha refers to basically those people around you who support your practice. Now, when you come, some people think it's kind of strange and weird because we do a lot of bowing, and we see somebody, we bow. But what's the bow? The bow basically does a number of things. One, it's an expression of humility and a loss of ego. But secondly, it's an appreciation for support. My practice, that you're here, you know what I mean, and you're helping support my practice. And then thirdly, it's an expression of the realization that we're all one. Remember, we're all one, non-self, all part of the Great Spirit, if you will. And so when I see that bow, it really means something with me. People are supporting my practice. Many of you haven't been here to actually sit and meditate in the morning or evening. But one thing we do is we come and you come in the room, and the first thing you do is you bow to your cushion. Now, the Zabutown down here, and you're facing away. You bow to your cushion. And what you're doing, you're not just bowing. Now, these are just not meaningless rituals, etc. But you're thinking of all those gazillions of people over 2,500 years who have developed a practice that's been passed on to you. And if you think about it, it's a lovely thought. A lovely thought. I'm thanking all those people. Thank you. And then I turn around and I bow to the room, which means I'm thanking everybody who's there supporting basically my practice. And so the Sangha is a very important part of our practice. I have a cabin up north, and way up in northern Minnesota. And if you go out into the woods, you'll see that the little pine trees, when they plant them, don't last long by themselves. The deer come and nibble them up. It must be like a piece of candy or whatever. And so what they do, basically, is they put kind of a plastic sheath around it to protect it. And you see that in the cities as well. They're protecting the tree. And I think many of us basically are like that little pine tree when we start a practice, etc. And that we're so vulnerable. We can be nibbled on by temptations. We can think of other things to do. So the Sangha, in a way, is that kind of sheath, etc., that kind of protects us until we develop a strong enough practice to hold it by ourselves. Then the last kind of practice I'd encourage you to start, if you don't already, is to actually to read the mystics, if you will. And draw inspiration. Because a lot of times it's so hard and difficult to keep up a practice, particularly if you get up and you're here at 5:45 in the morning and it's raining. And the last couple of years, of course, I live upstairs, and I have a hard time getting from there down here. And there are a couple of people who come on their bicycles, and here it is, the wind is howling, it's snowing like mad, and they bicycle up, and they're all covered with stuff, etc., etc. Well, where do you get that inspiration from? And one source, of course, is to read the great mystics, etc., to read about the life of the Buddha. But there are many other people, etc. For example, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, or Sri Ramana's life story, or Teresa of Avila, etc. There is the Buddha's, the Dharmapada, the book I mentioned we're going to use this fall in the practice period, or Dogen again, our founders, Shobo Genzo, and on and on and on. And so there are really a lot of great inspirational readings. Somebody once said that religions basically are like a mountain, that below the tree level they're all different. Tropical forest, conifer forest, above the tree level they're all the same, etc. And so when you reach the very upper level with Teresa, etc., or Ramakrishna, etc., etc., I think it's pretty pretty similar, etc. Just two thoughts on that. One is that I've learned that when you read spiritual stories, or you look at words, sentences, etc., in something like Buddhism, you learn that they're what we call numinous, that word numinous, N-U, numinous. And what that word means is that their meaning changes as the depth of our understanding increases. Okay? And we often think of a word, let's look the definition up in the dictionary, right? And that's the definition. And we hold on. So one reading's good enough, right? Because we're going to get it. But basically, in any kind of spiritual tradition with great depth, except we realize basically that the meaning is going to mature through time as the depth of our understanding matures. And so this means you read and you reread. And a good practice basically is every evening before you go to bed, just read a page or two. Read a page or two. Okay, well, let me end basically with a quick reference to three roadblocks. We're just about done here. Three roadblocks along the way. Usually I don't talk about these, but so far I've made it sound, well, this is pretty pretty easy. And I'm just going to mention three. One is lack of interest and effort, etc. And a lot of times people just aren't interested enough. They don't know enough. And so I encourage people to take classes and read, etc., and just learn enough about it. And a lack of effort, again, is develop a meditation practice. And I could say more about these, but I'm not. A second problem is what I call confusion, and that is confusion about what exactly you're doing. What exactly you're doing. Because people, you take a class and somebody says, well, let's count your breath. And then you find out that the Buddha wandered around for 6 years searching. He sat under that Bodhi tree and he didn't count his breath. I can guarantee you that, etc. So part of the problem is getting good instruction about what it's about and what you're doing, etc. And a third problem a little bit is trying too hard. That if you do all of these things, you develop effort, etc., you have some understanding, you just try too hard. And so you people just sit there and sit there and sit there in your meditation posture, etc. And when you have to learn, of course, just to let it come. Be at ease. Let it arise, etc. Trying too hard is as bad as not trying hard enough. And finally, find a teacher. One thing that's very important in Buddhism, all forms of Buddhism, etc., is to have somebody like our abbot, Tim Burkett, etc., to actually advise you along the way. There are many traps, many false leads, false confidences, etc., and it helps at all levels, basically, have a teacher. Thanks very much.